Today is Women's Wednesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Women's Wednesday, we focus on all things for and about women.
I'd like to introduce you to today's guest. Her name is Tonya Kane, and Tonya is the author of a book entitled Healing Neen. Tonya, welcome to Mind Talk.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Now, Tonya, I'm just going to share with the audience a little bit about the description of your book, and then we will begin to have our own dialogue. This is a quote, folks. It says, "It is almost unfathomable to believe that just 9 years ago, Neen was in prison, a place as familiar to her as the streets she lived on. In just 15 years, she had been arrested 83 times with 66 convictions." Tonya, talk to us about what made you decide to write this book and explain why it is titled Healing Neen.
Absolutely. Well, Healing Neen is, Neen was my street name. My name is Tonya, but my middle name is Deneen.
Okay.
So everybody in my family, like a lot of people, have nicknames, and my nickname was Neen.
Okay.
Given to me by my family, you know, at a very young age, and it followed me even when I was in the streets. So, you know, you weren't really healing Tonya because I never really got a chance to be Tonya. Mm-hmm. I was always Neen, that crack addict, that prostitute, that mental health consumer. That's who I was. So it was Neen that needed to be healing and Tonya that needed to be freed. So, and also Healing Neen is based on, I have a documentary that's award-winning that's on five continents helping to change cycles. Yeah, so, and it's titled Healing Neen as well. But it's a 55-minute video, and you really just get just a glimpse of the trauma. And everybody kept saying, when are you going to write the book? When are you going to write the book? When are you going to write the book? So, because people needed to know what was leading up, what was happening right before some of those traumatic experiences. So I wrote the book. And I actually got the book deal based on the DVD, the film.
Interesting.
And I got a book deal before I even had a book, so which was pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. Now, you've just said a couple of things that have just sort of rolled off your tongue. You've said crack. You've said prostitution. You've said mental health consumer. That seems like there was a lot of stuff going on in your life.
Yeah. Well, you know, by the time I was 19, I had been, at a very young age, I was in a situation with my mother. She's my mother, you know, she drank. She was a single mom, and I was the oldest. I'm the oldest of 10. So there was oftentimes whatever she had been through, she didn't know how to deal with it. So hers came out same way mine ended up coming out, and she coped with it and the alcoholism, and it was a very neglectful situation where I was left in the house, you know, with my siblings, and we weren't attended to as parents should a child. So I had that situation, but also very young, I started to be molested and sexually abused. And I really didn't know how to I didn't talk about it because I thought that I would be blamed. Mm-hmm. I thought that there's something so wrong about me that will make somebody want to do something like that to me. You know, I can tell you this, I knew it was wrong because it felt wrong. It was hurtful.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way I dealt with it was I would always find these half-filled cups from my mother's last night party, and I would start to drink it at age 9. And at age 9, I found my coping mechanism. I found something that could help me numb. So I would always look for those half-filled cups, and I would drink them. Because you know what? When I was in those moments where I felt like I was being neglected or abandoned or beaten for no reason and all of that, it didn't feel as bad. And when the men came, it didn't feel as ashamed. It wasn't as shameful. So I started to drink at age 9.
Let me ask you this. I know there's some people who are hearing you say that you started to drink at age 9, and there's somebody, at least one person, who's saying, age 9? Who starts drinking at age 9? But in fact, a lot of children start drinking at a very early age.
Yes, and that's what I did because, my first experiment was I'm just going to drink it because when they all drink it, they laugh and party and having fun. So I'm going to drink it and, I want to laugh. I want to have fun too. So right. I experimented for that reason. But what I realized was it became the way I could deal with what was going on in my life. So I always, not that I could always find it, but there were many, many parties and there were many, many people bringing alcohol into my mother's household, because she drank.
Okay.
And I even when the party, it got to the point before the party was over, I would sneak in the kitchen. I'd sneak somewhere and I'd grab me a cup or a bottle. I'd sneak in somebody's bag or anything just to get that feeling, just to get that feeling of not dealing with who I was and what I was going through.
Let's back up a bit. I'd like for you to give us a thumbnail sketch of sort of a day in the life of. You didn't always have 9 siblings.
Right.
So when you were about, let's say between 5 and 8, give us a thumbnail sketch of a day in your life between 5 and 8.
Well, I start telling about my trauma age 9 because between 5 and 8, I was with my grandmother.
Okay.
And that life was, my grandmother loved me. She showed me love. I was never hungry. I was never responsible for kids. None of that. What happened before I was 5, around 4 years old, I had chronic asthma. And I end up in a hospital surrounded by plastic because my asthma was so chronic.
Mm.
So my grandmother took me away from my mother because she didn't think she would be able to take care of me.
Okay.
And so that time, between 5 and 8, it was pretty good. But my grandmother died around the end of that.
Mm.
And I had to go back and live with my mother. And, I knew my mother. I spent time with my mother because I would be sent down there on weekends and things like that. But when you go from that type of situation where have somebody that showed you love to a situation where there was absolutely no display of love, and I was thrown into a situation that I was not prepared for. No kid would be prepared for it, but it took my breath away. My days were, I would wake up, and for the most part, we missed a lot of days in school. But the days that I would go to school, I was teased. I was teased, about it when I went back to my mother because we were filthy. We were dirty. We were filthy. And I smelled like urine all the time. I was a bed. Well, not only was I a bed, but I had a bunch of young brothers and sisters sleeping with me in the same bed, and and they were babies, and it was a pissy good time going on. And I would wake up and I'll go to school, and kids would circle me and call me Pissy Mean. There it is again, that name, Pissy Mean. And I would run into the bathroom, huddle down in a stall. The teacher would come and get me and start today's lesson, but there was no kind of dialogue about it, no communication. Are you okay? Why do you smell bad? Why aren't you being taken care of? None of that. And then I would just go back home and be the older sister or just be with my siblings. And they were everything to me. As I, we all we had was our each other.
When you got back home, when you got back home to deal with your siblings, what were your jobs in terms of dealing with your siblings? Were you like their mom?
Well, I mean, I certainly didn't know how to be a mother, but I knew one thing. I knew we had to eat.
Okay.
And a lot of times we didn't have food. Back then the government used to give us like the block of cheese and things like that. But when the cheese was gone, I would always try to open up those huge canned goods with a knife. We never had a can opener. So I did what I would see my mother do. She would put a knife on top and she would bang with something hard trying to open that way. And I cut myself trying to do that once, but we had to eat, I wanted us to eat. And, so I would come home. If my mother, sometimes my mother was there, and a lot of times she wasn't. We would come home, and we would scramble with something to eat, or she would make these flour cakes. It would just be flour and water, or it, I mean, it just really wasn't anything. And
mm-hmm.
or what the WIC program would give
mm-hmm.
us to eat. You know, because whatever she did with the, you know, she even lost her food stamps or sold them or whatever she did with the food stamps.
Okay.
I really cannot remember ever, maybe once, my mother going grocery shopping.
Interesting.
And so that's what I would do. And then I would cut, we had these old dirty sheets up against the windows as curtains. And I would just tear little by little off to make diapers for my brothers and sisters.
Oh, my.
For my brothers. It was my brothers that was little at that time.
Okay.
And I would do that, and I would find plastic bags and put on top of it. You know, I knew how to do that. You know, I knew how to burp a baby. I knew how to, you know, feed them. I knew how to change very early on in life.
So now, at this point, you're about 9, 10, 11 years old?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And the abuse started while you were at mother's home?
Well, the first time I was molested, I was actually living with my grandmother, and it was somebody that was the recreation director at our community rec center.
Huh.
So that was my first experience, you know, and that was, it was touching. It, you know, it didn't go any further than that, but, you know, you have somebody took me into a closed room and did that to me. And again, I didn't tell my grandmother, you know, because
right.
I was afraid I wasn't supposed to be in the rec hall. And,
okay.
And so by the time I got with my mother, I already knew how to keep a secret.
Mm.
I knew how to keep secrets, you know.
And painful secrets at that.
Painful secrets. And, you know, and I would just put them down in a real dark, dark place inside of me.
Of course. You had to figure out a way to get through every day.
Yeah. And I you know, and it was, for the most part, it was my siblings. You know what I mean? And knowing that I could be there to have to take care of them, and they take care of me in their own way, and we had each other. We had to stay strong for each other and be with each other.
And how long did this go on?
Well, by the time I was at 11, a couple of years, and then at 11, we were taken away from my mother and put into foster care. And you're talking about devastation, you know, because this is what the system failed to get sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
When you don't prepare children
right.
for something so scary and so unfamiliar, you're just causing more trauma.
Right.
You're causing, it's hard, to, as bad as the situation was with my mother, it still was my mother, and that still you have the children's love for their parents. And you, all they know is who they know, and to snatch them and separate them. For me to be separated from all my brothers and sisters, you're talking about devastation? And just not knowing the unfamiliar. You know, back then, I don't know what really goes on now, but children weren't prepared for foster care. They were
right.
just snatched and just put on somebody's doorstep. You ring the bell, and here's this family. You have no idea who they are or what they are capable of.
Why you're there, and if it's forever, you have no idea.
You have no idea. You have no idea. And there is nothing that will help prepare children why they're there either. There's no therapy. They don't bring you in a room and say, you know, this is what's happening. This is the family that you're going to stay with. You know, and no, you just take into this unfamiliar territory, and you're supposed to just settle right in. And guess what? The next day you go to school.
Wow.
Tonya,
it sounds, for a little child, I mean, it absolutely sounds terrifying. We're going to take a break, and we will be right back to continue our conversation. Folks, you are listening to Mind Talk. My name is Pamela Brewer. I am talking with Tonya Kane, who is the author of Healing Neen. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks, to this edition of Mind Talk. My name is Pamela Brewer, and I am talking with Tonya Kane, who is the author of Healing Neen, One Woman's Path to Salvation from Trauma and Addiction. Tonya, just before the break, you were about 11 years old and in foster care, separated from your siblings, no idea what, where, how, why, when, nothing, just there. What was that like for you?
It was terrifying. It was humiliating. It was devastating. You know, it was my sisters and brothers that gave me the joy I had, was to be surrounded by them. No matter what the environment was like, I had them, and that was love. And even with trying to find a way to get into my mother's heart, that's what I always thought I had to do. Mm. If only I can make her proud of me, she'll love me. Only if I can make her proud of me, she'll love me. And to be able ripped from that situation and not prepared, it was devastating. It was devastating.
And it sounds so, it's almost breathtaking in how devastating and how empty and how lost you would feel. And no contact with siblings, no contact with mom.
No, not while I was in foster care. And the thing with my foster care, I was with my sister, and we were together. I mean, when you take so many kids, you can't put them all in one foster care. Right. Nobody's taking that many kids. So I had my sister, and we were in foster care for a short period of time. Then we ended up going to court and had family members that chose each and every one of us. But again, I mean, at least we're family now, but we're still separated. We're still not together as a family.
Right.
You know, you have, by then it was about seven of us, and we were all just put into all these different homes. And they were family homes, but we weren't seeing each other every day. We became a part of somebody else's family.
Was there a time that you felt safe?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Was there a time when you felt safe in the foster care home, or did you never feel safe?
I never felt safe in foster care, not until I ended up with my cousin. I never felt safe because I was scared.
Mm-hmm.
I was terrified, and when there's no way you can feel safe when any given moment you don't know what is about to happen. Well, the foster care, what I remember of her, she was nice enough. Mm-hmm. She fed me. She gave me clothes to put on. But, other than that, it was still very fearful. I was afraid.
Yeah. And, what's interesting, I'm listening to you as you talk about having food and having clothes and being clean or being dirty. And there's so many people who take all of that for granted. And for you, being loved meant having food and clean clothes to wear.
Yes. And that's what it is. If I could just only have love, that's what it boils down to for me. The lack of love, mm-hmm. That's the nourishing, to have that nurturing and,
right.
You look at nurturing, you look at nourishment, nurture me. I need to be nurtured. I need to be known as all children.
Right.
This is not unique. All children need
right.
to be loved. You think about why kids are joining gangs. People
exactly.
looking for acceptance to be a part of, to be loved.
Right. You're absolutely right. How long were you in foster care?
I don't remember exactly how long. I don't know if it was 2 weeks, a month, or whatever. It was a short period of time before we went back to court. I do know that. I don't know exactly how many nights, how many days a week.
And then when you went back to court, that's when various family members took you in.
Yes.
And then there came a point when you went back to your mother.
After living with my cousin for 3 years,
mm-hmm.
At this point, nobody was teasing me. Nobody was touching me. And I felt safe.
Okay.
I did, I did. She treated me like I was her own. She had three daughters around my age. And it reminded me back at the time I was with my grandmother, And after 3 years, my mother came back and asked me to come back with her. Of course I went back because she's my mother.
Right.
Because I always craved my mother's love. And that's what I thought it was going to be. I thought, I'm older now. I can handle things better. It's going to be better because she said she loved me. I didn't hesitate. I ran upstairs and I packed all the things that I accumulated over those 3 years that I was given. I packed it proudly, and off into the sunset I went with my mother.
And
well, it wasn't about a week later, I realized that nothing had really changed. And for me, I just couldn't deal with it because what I realized was I can't live with her and I don't want to live without her. And I preferred to die at that point. I really did. Nothing changed. She had beat me for something that she thought I was trying to hit her back or something. And I ran away. I ran away and I ended up going to my cousin's house and going in the bathroom because somewhere in my life, I don't remember who, but somebody planted a pill. If you take a bottle of pills, you'll die. So I took a whole bottle of one of my relatives' pills. And when I woke up in the emergency room, nobody asked me why.
That's extraordinary.
Nobody.
That's extraordinary.
Nobody asked me why. They talked to my mother who told them that it was my own medication that I had accidentally took too many of.
And they bought
and
that.
They were satisfied with that.
Okay. And then you went back to your mother.
I went back to her for maybe a few nights. And at this point, I think she really got scared. Because I think she really just didn't know what to do with me. And she told me I can go live with her sister, my Aunt Carol. And
okay.
And I went there. And she was already raising my sister, Bridget, who is the second oldest.
Okay.
And so, which was wonderful. I was with, you know, I mean, her was the oldest. And I was with them. And, you know, and I ate. I went to school. And I weren't abused. It felt better, but by then I experienced so much trauma,
yeah,
so much suffering. Nothing felt really safe anymore.
Now,
nothing
at one point when you went to live with your mother, one of those times you went back and she had three more children.
Yes, yeah, she had three more. I had three sisters, which made the 10.
Right.
I had three more sisters, but I also went back to drinking.
Okay.
I also went back to drinking. So by the age of 15, I was an alcoholic.
That is a stunning statement. You realize that, and not all that uncommon.
Yeah, exactly. So no matter where I went from that point on, you know, I wouldn't do well. I went to my aunt's house, and I drank. And, you know, I continued to drinking. You know, they had their, you know, their beverages after they get off from work. You know, they had their beers and their wines and everything. And I would just every single day. Just steal beer and liquor and every single day. I remember standing out at the bus stop. A time back, they used to sell grapefruit juice in a glass jar. And I would fill out half the grapefruit juice and fill half of it up with gin and take it to school like that. And I drank on it all day long in school.
At school.
At school.
Nobody,
all day long, I would just drink on it all day long.
And nobody noticed, nobody asked you anything.
Nobody noticed, nobody asked. And believe me, I wasn't the only one at the bus stop with alcohol or a marijuana joint. I wasn't. It was a lot of kids drinking. It wasn't uncommon.
And at that point, you were about 15.
Yeah. I was about 15, and then I finally got convinced my aunt to let me get a job where this guy who ended up being one of my mother's favorite drinking buddies he thought I was cute. Those are the words he used. You're cute. And he wanted me to be his. And he would just supply my mother with alcohol every weekend. And, you know, they were drinking buddies. And he was 24. I was just turning 16. And I thought maybe he could protect me from all the other men in my life. And he ended up being the worst of all the people that's ever hurt me.
He ended up being the worst.
Yes. And I really mean that, you know what I mean? And I've been abused sexually. As a child, but this man, and the reason why it felt worse than anything else, because it was such a betrayal. It was, you know, because I trust him. I never trusted anybody, all those other men. I didn't know them, but I trusted this man. And he knew how old I was. Matter of fact, my mother had to sign a marriage license for me to marry him.
You actually married him. How old were you when you married him?
My mother signed the papers when I was 17.
Okay.
My mother signed the papers when I was 17, and I moved in with him. I got pregnant, didn't finish high school, and I remember the first time he beat me and stomped me. I thought I was looking at. I could not believe. I thought it was. I thought it was somebody else. Thought it was somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the beating started. And it. That's the way he treated me.
And
he treated
was
me
this
like a possession and like his possession, and, you know, by the time I'm with him, I'm not working. When he felt like he was finished with me, he left me.
When he started beating you, were you pregnant?
The first time he hit me, I was pregnant.
Wow.
I remember he was on the phone talking to somebody, a woman, and I asked him, why is he doing this? Why are he talking to her? And he just started pounding me in my side. From that point on, I had difficulties with my pregnancy.
And your pregnancy came to term?
It did. It came to term. It came to term. And I had my oldest son. And for me, it was like, everything going to be okay now. Everything going to be okay. I have somebody I can love, and they're going to love me. No more do I have to search for love. I have a baby that will adore me, and I will adore my baby. And this man took that away from me.
How so? What do you mean?
He left. The rent didn't get paid, and he ended up saying this was an excuse. I got to go live somewhere else, and he left me, and I had to end up going to live back with my mother. With my son. And
so he just got up and left. He just physically left.
Physically left me.
You deal with this.
I had no money. I mean, he did take care of my son. He took care of my son. And, you know, he provided him with, but I had to go on welfare. He would buy him Pampers and stuff like that. But other than that, I wasn't getting like child support money, nothing like that.
Okay.
He would just buy him Pampers or shoes when he needed or things like that. And after 2 years, I had gone out for the weekend. And but by then, you know what I mean? By then, I had been dipping and dabbing with coke. You know what I mean?
Okay.
And the alcoholism just kind of advanced to the drugs.
Okay.
And but it wasn't, I'd maintained it the best way I could. But so I was out for 1 weekend with a drug dealer that that was liking me anyway. So when I came back, because my mother's watching my son, my husband had picked him up. And that's when he was 2 years old. And I didn't see my son again. I found my son at 21, and he said he couldn't have a relationship with me. And
at 21 you didn't see him.
At 2 years old, as a punishment. And
what did he claim he was punishing you for? He actually punished you and your son.
I have no idea. I think he just felt like, and I think that in his mind, he thought he was doing the right thing. I really do. I can't think for him, but I think because he had a girlfriend by then that he was living with. So I guess he thought that he can give my son a better life, you know,
but he stole him.
Cut me off. He cut me off altogether. He cut me off. By then, I had my son Brandon also. This was a couple of years later, and I had my son Brandon. And so he took Keith, and I spiraled downward. And because it was just too much. It was, if all I had went through to have my firstborn snatched from me, taken, I couldn't visit him, I couldn't see him, I couldn't hug him, I couldn't kiss him, I could not tell him that I loved him. And I spiraled down. I end up with my son, and at that point, the drugs had got to be a part of my everyday life. And I just could not stand feeling. I could not stand feeling. I hated the fact that I felt. And in order to deal with that, crack cocaine was the best answer for me. At that time, because it was the one thing that stopped me from blowing my brains out.
Oh my gosh!
And I used this drug, and I didn't have to care anymore. I didn't have to care anymore. But the problem was I had to keep getting it. I had to keep using it.
Right.
In order to do that, I went to prostituting. I went to panhandling. I went to committing all these crimes. And as a result, I end up pregnant with my daughter, and which is makes it a very difficult day for me today, because it was 25 years ago that I had her, and today's her birthday. So it's
Tonya,
a pretty difficult day for me.
I understand. Tonya, let's do this. Let's take a little mini break and come back, and we'll continue with our dialogue. Folks, this is... Hello, everyone. This is Pamela Brewer welcoming you back to this edition of Mind Talk, into a continuing conversation with Tonya Cain, who is the author of Healing Neen. Tonya, today would have been your daughter's 25th birthday. Are you up for talking about her?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. You know, as painful as it is, you know, I have better coping skills today than I did 10 years ago. And I tell it because I know it will help somebody. And when I tell you that at this point of when I had my daughter, I don't know who her father is. I was out there prostituting.
Mm.
But I can tell you, 7 months pregnant, 25 years ago, this is how bad my life was. I spent this whole 7 months shooting. I went from crack to actually shooting in my veins.
Mm.
And at 7 months pregnant, I was prostituting. And I'm with this guy. We're in the midst of the sexual intercourse. My water breaks.
Oh, my.
My water breaks. He gives me $10. I had so much pain, so much pain inside of me. When he gave me that $10, I went to a shooting gallery. This is what we call places where you can go and shoot drugs. I went there. Water has gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there, and I get the woman that in her house to go get me $10 worth of coke to shoot my veins before I went to the hospital.
Oh, my word.
Everything was against my daughter. It was. Mm. It was. But I was in so much pain, I could not not do it.
Right.
I could not not do it. And when I got to the hospital, they told me that they weren't going to give me an anesthesia because, you know, they actually... Have you been doing drugs? Which I thought was the most ridiculous question ever. And, you know, everything about me
said drugs. Yeah.
Junkie. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I said, yeah. And so they said, well, we're not going to give you anything for pain because we don't know how much you have in you. So I had her. I pushed out natural. And she was 4 pounds. She was 4 pounds. And they said she had to stay in the NIC unit. And, but the first hospital I went to, they would say, there's no way you can deliver your baby. Your baby here. Your baby's in trouble. So they sent me to Baltimore, and I had my baby there. And I went home, but I would call collect. I had to call the hospital collect.
To find
collect
out about your baby. Yeah.
Just to find out how she was every single day, because I lived in Annapolis. It was about 30, 40 miles away, and I didn't have anything.
And that's Annapolis, Maryland.
I had my son who I can't handle him with. And the only way I got money was, I went right back to prostituting right after I had a baby.
Oh,
right after I had a baby. And I called every day, and then one day they said, well, you can come get her tomorrow. This was 10 days later, August 23rd. And they said, you can come and get her. this is 1989, and I got on the bus. My mother was watching my son, and I was so filthy. People kept looking at me. I had a dirty scarf around my head, a do-rag, real filthy. I was dirty, and I was filthy, and I smelled bad, and I knew it, and I knew it. And people were looking at me, but I didn't care because I was going to get my daughter, and they said, you have to bring her something to wear because, you know, to take her home in.
Right.
So I went and sold this little yellow dress. That's why I call it Sunshine, because the dress was yellow. And I thought things were going to change now, because now I had a daughter I had to protect, because I know what people do to little girls. And I'm not going to let that happen to her. And I'm going to protect her. And this is all what I'm thinking on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
It was the public bus I'm taking the whole way up to Baltimore. And when I get there, they put her on my arm, and I put that little dress on her, and I promised her, I'm going to take care of you. It's mm-hmm. going to be different. I'm going to do everything I can to protect you. Nobody going to hurt you. And that's what I told her. And I got in the hospital, actually had a transportation that would bring me back to Annapolis.
Okay.
When I got back, I'm showing my daughter off, and I see the police pull up. I seen it, and my heart dropped. I knew it. And when they got out with a social worker, and they took her out of my arms, and they took my son, and they put me in the back of the police car. The same day I bring her home,
and
a few hours later.
And what was all of that about?
Well, because she was born with drugs in her system, so I think the social worker is coming to check on my living arrangements, to check on her.
Uh-huh.
But because they wouldn't come in the community without a police officer, when I live in Annapolis, we have one police department. When they told the police officer my name, of course, there was a warrant for my arrest or something that probably was outstanding.
Okay.
So when they didn't just do a house visit, they actually came to take her and lock me up.
Okay.
You know, they didn't, you know, back then they didn't charge people with, you know, children with drugs in a system. And I got in the back of the car, and the social worker had my two kids, my baby daughter, in her little yellow dress, and my son looking back, crying,
and
pulling him off.
And
they
I know
put
that
me in a police car.
That touched something in you, I know.
You talked about darkness. So by then, I had lost every child I ever given birth to. And there was nothing left. There was nothing. Nothing left for me to hold on to. There was no hope. There was nothing. Absolutely nothing at that point. So I went to jail for a short period of time. I got out, and I ended up the cycle all over again. But this was in a way that was 10 times worse.
I can imagine.
I was beat and raped on a daily basis.
Hmm.
Yep. And I ended up getting pregnant again. I used to prostitute in this area where it was Latinos, and I would prostitute over there. And this couple of years later, I ended up pregnant with my youngest son.
This is all in areas of Maryland. Maryland.
This
Baltimore
is in
Maryland.
The beautiful city everybody says, Annapolis, Maryland.
Yeah.
Yes, Annapolis had projects. They do. So, this is all in the same city. And I had Brandon, and this time I tried. I went rehab, and I failed. I just could not know. I didn't know how to feel it. I didn't know how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how to deal with Keith, Brandon, and Whitney gone. I didn't know how to deal with the memories of all the rapes, the beating as a child, as an adolescent, as an adult. I didn't know how to deal with the feeling like there was no worth in me. I just didn't know how to deal with it. And every system was telling me that I was nothing, that I was going to spend the rest of my life going in and out of prison. I was going to die in the street. And everybody dealt with me, did their bare minimum, because there was no hope for Tonier Kane.
That's what they believed, and that's what they taught you to believe.
That's what they believed. That's how they treated me, and some of them even told me.
Mm.
I didn't know how to feel. I didn't know how to feel it and not become destructive. I didn't.
Right. At some point, something happened in your life, because clearly you were not going any place that was good. 86, 83 arrests, 66 convictions. The police had to know your name by heart. They probably had to know you on a first name basis. They could probably see you coming a mile away. But your life today is so incredibly different. What happened?
Well, 10 years ago, I'm in prison and I'm pregnant again. And I'm terrified. See, because I can deal with the rapes and the beatings. I learned to deal with the rapes and the beatings on the streets. I did. I learned to deal with it. It's part of my life. I dealt with it. But what I couldn't deal with most of all is having a baby snatched from my arms. And I knew that was coming. Because here I was in prison, 2004, pregnant again. And I'm going to have another baby yet again snatched from my arms.
And this was your sixth child?
My fifth child.
Your fifth child, okay.
Now, mind you, in the book, it talks about two other pregnancies that I, traumatic pregnancies I had where both babies died at 5 months. This was my seventh pregnancy and my fifth living child. So I'm in prison, I'm pregnant, and I'm terrified. And I remember somebody telling me somewhere, if all else fail, why not look up to God? And so out of desperation, I laid on my concrete floor in my prison. I started crying. And I was praying, but I didn't know if God was hearing me. I just kept praying. I didn't want to stop praying. I did it for hours on the concrete floor. And even though that everybody told me that there's nothing they could do, not long after that, I would hear about a program called Tamar's Children. And they said, they said, it works on your trauma. I said, well, I don't have that, because I always thought trauma was when you get hit by a car or when you come back from the war.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought trauma was. I didn't know trauma was being sexually abused, being abandoned, being neglect, mm-hmm. the domestic violence, having my kids taken away from me, even me being taken away from my mother. I didn't know that this was trauma, because where I come from, this happened to most people. This was the norm.
This was every day.
Mm. Right. So they said, no, these things aren't supposed to happen to you, and so on and so forth. And they said they can work on my addiction, my mental health, and I can keep my baby with you. And Dr. Brewer, I'm going to tell you, the only reason why I wanted to go to this program, because in my mind I thought, if only this time they allow me to keep my baby for more than 3 hours, it will be different.
Yeah.
If only it could be more than 3 hours this time, it may be different. That was what I was thinking. So oh my goodness, in the book it tell you what I had to go through to finally get to the program. You know, when I got to the program, the first thing somebody said to me is, Tonir, we're so glad you made it. After 19 years of living in the streets, people shaking their head at disgust, telling me that I had no hope. Somebody was glad to see me. And my trauma therapist said, Tonir, we're going to start with the trauma that first affected you, and I want you to know everything that happened to you as a child happened to you. You didn't do to yourself. And I started to, work piece by piece of everything that ever affected me. The first thing we started working on was the issue of my mother, the neglect and abandonment.
Right.
And after crying about it, I had to realize, it's going to be okay, because it is what it is. And I had to go through so much pain, so many tears, so many crying, so many times I was rocking and I was crying and I felt pain. But I kept talking and I kept talking, and at night I kept praying. So I was not only had trauma therapy, but I had developed a relationship with God, and I did everything that I thought I was supposed to do, and I stayed close to God, and I stayed in these sessions that were so painful. And I finally was able to change my belief system from I am nothing to I am somebody, and I can be anything I want in this world. See, Dr. Brewer, when my belief system changed, my thought process changed.
Right.
And I started to make best decisions in my life. I started to realize that, yes, I did what I had to do 10 years ago to help me to cope. So now I need to rethink my coping mechanisms and find more healthier tools to deal with the things that happened to me.
Tonya, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. This is Pamela Brewer welcoming you back to this edition of Mind Talk and to a conversation with Tonya Kane, who is the author of Healing Neen, One Woman's Path to Salvation from Trauma and Addiction. And her life has been stunning in so many ways. Tonya, you found this program. You were able to change how you thought about yourself. You were able to change what you were willing to accept in your life. Tell us about your life today.
Oh, my goodness. It still blows my mind. My daughter that I was in prison with and I ended up going into the program, the trauma program, she'll be 10 years old on Friday.
Ah.
And
she's with you.
I marvel at this little girl.
She's with you. She's with you.
Yeah. Yes. She's always been with me.
Wonderful.
You know, I went to the program, I did well, and I went on my own with my daughter, and never again did I have a desire to use drugs and alcohol. Never again did I end up back in the system. Never again did I feel like that I had to do something destructive to help me to deal. No, I didn't. So I have this daughter, and it's amazing because I look at her life like she travels. I travel, you know, we travel outside the country. I travel a lot, and she travels with me. She goes to this incredible private school in Maryland, and she's just amazing. She tested in the highest percentile in our nation for the last couple of years.
Wow.
For the national standardized test. And she takes French 4 times a week. She's so smart. Wherever you see my daughter, she has a book. And even though I brought her a Nook, she likes to hold that book in her hand. And she's so much smarter than me already. She does this one thing that I absolutely just do not like. She corrects my grammar. And I don't mind her doing it at home, but when we're in the store in the line, it's kind of embarrassing. But
she sounds like an old soul.
Yeah, she is. She really is. But she's brilliant. She knows the Word of God. She can recite every book in the Bible from Genesis to Revelations in order without missing a beat. And she's very active in the church. And we're talking about 360 degree from what my childhood was like.
Absolutely.
And that's what it's really about for me. I train providers to how to deal with trauma survivors. Why it's so impactful, because I know that there's hope. I'm
right.
Living the hope, because in order to for things to get better, we have to break generational cycles. See, my daughter doesn't know what it's like to live in the projects. I'm not saying anything's wrong, but she doesn't know what it's like to live
right.
Somewhere challenging, where she doesn't feel safe, or in a household where she's not being nurtured and loved and taken care of. And believe me, she, as smart as she is, she's also a diva. There was a time they were, you know, we were doing a film thing out in Hollywood. And I would take her to, we stayed in the Beverly Hilton Hotel a couple of times. So she was, the last time we went, she was post Whitney Houston's death. And she goes up and she says, "Excuse me, please don't put us in a room where Whitney Houston died, okay?" She kids are sponges. They hear things and they take it on. They really is. So she likes Rodeo Drive, and she loves all the finer things in life. She likes fine dining, but she's my best friend. She really is, and she's the love of my life. She does not replace my 4 other kids. She doesn't.
Of course not.
But,
yeah.
But God restored a child. She gave me another chance to be a mom. Because I remember when I laid on the concrete floor and I was asking God to let me keep her, I did say, "Well, don't let me keep if I hurt her. Please provide," because I didn't have any education. I didn't have any. I had 83 arrests and 66 convictions. Who's going to hire me?
Right.
But today I'm one of, the leading expert in trauma for our government. I have, 10 years ago they told me I was going to spend the rest of my life going in and out of prison or dying in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
Today I have days named after me in states and cities.
Amazing. Good for you. That just sends chills. I mean, that is extraordinary. It speaks so much, though, to all that was inside of you that you didn't know about, but you learned about it.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's extraordinary. For folks who are listening, who perhaps have that child, that teenager, teenagers, being a teenager, as you know, is a scary time both for the teenager and for the parents. What do you want parents to be mindful of as you think back on who and how you were as a teen and how vulnerable you were as a teen?
Well, you know, I always tell, because I get that question a lot from people, you know, I'm known in not only this country, a lot of other countries. I get emails, like, from people that, family members that are in distress. And I always tell people that, for one, never give up on them. Always know that there is hope. And there is, we need to start asking what happened to you instead of what is wrong with you. Why can't you get it together? We need to start understanding the importance of asking, did something happen? What happened? And for the most part, I always tell family members to move out of the way and bring in an expert. I really do. Because sometimes the way that our love or that enabling, we can sometimes get in the way of growth for our loved ones. And we got to continue to show them that we support them, that we have hope for them, that we love them. But, and then consult with a professional and kind of get out the way and let somebody that is in the professional, you know, as a professional,
sure,
help you out. And I always tell people that. And because it's so much more than what the eye can see, you know?
Now, let me ask you this. You are an African-American woman. And as you know, many times, although it's so much less than it used to be, but many times African-American folks, I don't really want to go to therapy. They don't think that it's going to, what's the point of talking about it? It's not going to change my situation. Can you speak to those people?
Yes, absolutely. And you're right, especially African-Americans. The first thing we do, we like to run down to the church. And, you know, we go there because we think that's where all the answers is. And I'm not saying that, you know, but we're dealing with, you know, a congregation, a clergy that really not trained in trauma. They're really not. Yes, we know the Lord. We'll pray for you. But it really doesn't give us anything tangible to use.
Mm-hmm.
Therapy is key. It really is. And I know that there is not, we don't believe in it as a nation, as a culture, but we need to do more awareness around it. People need to know that it's in the right therapy. And sometimes you might not feel right with the first therapist. You keep looking. It's just like, you don't, when you buying a pair of shoes, you don't buy the first pair of shoes. I know I don't, because I like to try on shoes. I don't buy the first pair of shoes I see. I try them on and see how they fit. I want to see how they fit when I walk. I want to see how I walk in. Is it going to be comfortable? Is it going to fit me? That's how we need to do when we're dealing with people that are in our lives that's there to help us. We need to shop for that right person.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times we just go, even with doctors, we go to the first one that somebody suggests and we settle. And you can't do that, because then you just lose that encouragement, because it don't feel good, so you don't want to go to the next person.
Right.
And I always encourage people that, you know, you might have to talk to a couple people before you find that one that will fit you. You have to find somebody that fits you and fit your needs.
Right.
You know, and to providers, I always tell them, if I could say this, when I'm training providers, I always tell them, you're supposed to be the GPS system for people. See, our job is to help to get those that we serve to their destination as safe as possible. Sometimes we need to give them turn-by-turn direction. But if we decide we're going to take over their life and tell them what to do every step of the way, why are we so surprised when they don't do well when we discharge them into the community?
Exactly.
Because we're not there to give them step-by-step. Our job is to allow them to control their life. And when I say that, bring them in on some of these decisions with these treatment plans. Talk to them. Ask them what worked for them and what doesn't work for them. Because guess what? You won't know if you don't ask. And realize who you are to that person, you know what I mean? And last but not least, one of the questions people always ask me, what's on here? How we know when somebody's ready? As a provider, guess what? Your job is to be ready for them, not for them to be ready for you. Because guess what? Mm-hmm. Nobody likes to be in the system.
Right. That is so well said. I thank you so much for saying that. You know, the idea that we can make, just as a body of people, black or white, but certainly for those who see themselves as being treated differently by virtue of how they look, speak, what they believe, who they are, whatever it is, it's so easy to settle for the first person who will agree to work with you. And right then and there, you're shaving off a little bit of your own self-esteem.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it really is important. I always tell folks, when you get a diagnosis, find out why. Why yeah. is it that, you know, what is it about you that makes this diagnosis the right fit? And a lot of folks will say, well, then the doctors get mad at me and they don't want to see me. Well, then, you know what? You don't want to see them either.
That's right. You don't want to be with them anyway. I've been given so many diagnoses, and today I don't even, you know what I mean? I don't have a diagnosis. You know, they diagnosed my behaviors, not what really was wrong. So, and we do that. We find that in the system. We like to keep people quiet, keep them calm. But all you're doing is medicating the symptoms. You know what I mean? And often over-medicating.
Yeah.
So we being misdiagnosed or over-diagnosed.
Tonier. Is that the correct pronunciation, Tonier?
Tonier.
Oh, Tonier. Mm-hmm. Okay, so finally, now that we have no more time, I have figured out how to pronounce your name. I do apologize.
That's okay.
Tonier.
Believe me, I heard worse.
Tonier Kane, author of Healing Neen, One Woman's Path to Salvation from Trauma and Addiction. Tonier, how do folks find out about the DVD, about your books, about where you are? How do folks follow up with you?
Okay, well, you can always go to my website, toniercane.com, and it has we try to keep that website updated with my events. Also, the film website, healingneen.com.
Okay.
So toniercane.com and healingneen.com. And the book can be bought wherever books are sold. It can be pre-ordered right now, and I just told a glimpse of what's all in that book, but it's a story of hope. So that can, you can go Amazon or Barnes and Nobles. It can be pre-ordered. It will be in the bookstore September 2nd.
Okay. Wonderful. Tonier, I thank you so much for sharing your life with us and certainly for all the work that you do, because I know you're saving lives every time you open up your mouth. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Dr. Brewer, for having me on.
All right. It has been my honor.
And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand 24/7 by going to myndtalk.org, or you can simply go to iTunes and download the Mind Talk app. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That is a confidential email address. Only I will see it. So again, that's pamela@myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, well, it's unacceptable. Take care.